Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be able to do one of these calls with you all. Thanks for taking the time. I'm going to speak for 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up to Q&A, and whatever questions you want to discuss, we'll discuss. But for opening remarks, I want to just lay out for you what the nature of the threat is today, how it's changed in Europe in particular. I assume that at least some of you will ask me how it's changed in the United States as well, and we can get to that then. What this means for Jewish communities in Europe in particular, and how prepared Europe is or is not to be able to deal with the threat, and there's good and there's bad news. I think the first thing that we need to recognize is that neither Europe nor Brussels had their aha moment at the Brussels bombings. That moment actually came 15 months ago, January 2015, not with the attacks in Paris targeting the Charlie Hebdo magazine, satirical magazine, and the hyper-kosher grocery, but a week later in eastern Brussels in the town of Revere. Authorities, presumably the United States, picked up through intelligence wiretaps that there was an Islamic State operative in Greece on a cell phone coordinating with unknown persons in Revere's, clearly for some type of operation. Belgian authorities conducted a raid. Two of their counterterrorism police officers were killed. And what they found really amazed them. It was an organized cell with a significant amount of TATP explosive. The chemical precursors were already there and were being assembled. This is the same type of explosive that was later used just now in the Brussels bombings at the airport and in the metro. You really need training to put together a TATP explosive. It's extremely volatile. You do not want to go over a speed bump if you're driving around in a car with TATP. You really need to know how to put this together. But they also found significant amount of weapons, ammunition, fake IDs, communication gear, and uniforms for Belgian police, making them think that possibly at least one part of the plot or plots would be to target Belgian authorities. But aside from the fact that it was such a large-scale plot in the making, there were two things about it that were really the wake-up moment for Europe in particular, and even in some ways for the United States. The first is that this was a foreign-directed plot by the Islamic State. That is to say, until that point, we were primarily concerned, in terms of Islamic State-specific attacks, with the homegrown violent extremist being inspired by the message of the Islamic State. And in this, the Islamic State has been far more successful than Al-Qaeda or bin Laden ever were in getting out a message that, for reasons I'll discuss in a minute, resonate with disenfranchised Muslim youth and inspire them to carry out an attack on their own without training. This is a real concern because it's very difficult for law enforcement to be able to find these people before they do something. I started my career in FBI and counterterrorism. And traditionally, what law enforcement and intelligence tends to do is to put out different types of tripwires. So we know we don't know what we don't know. We know there are things out there that we're not yet aware of. But we do know about that particular person or that particular front organization or this particular way of moving money suspiciously. And so you put out tripwires specifically related to communications, travel, and money. But what if you have someone who's being radicalized by watching one too many Islamic State videos in his mama's basement, and he or she, for that matter, has never traveled to a suspicious area and has never been on the phone or on other types of communication with people that we already know about, and by the way, increasingly maybe have been in communication but through means through which we don't have the ability to intercept, for example, WhatsApp, which is the most common texting platform in the world. One in seven people on planet Earth have WhatsApp, and it's completely secure end-to-end. And what if these people haven't sent or received money from people we know about? The good news is that while it's harder to identify and then stop them before they do something, they're also far less trained, far less capable, and therefore we're not talking about really spectacular types of attacks. What we saw in Revere's was plotting for something that was directed by operatives in the Islamic State, specifically recruiting European recruits to go back to Europe and do things in the countries in which they grew up. And because they lived there and because they spoke the language and knew the culture and society, they were extremely well placed to do so. And in Syria and Iraq, they had received some measure of explosives training, of small arms training. We saw, for example, in this past November in the attacks in Paris, and you can see the videos of people as they are moving around with their weapons. They're careful not to be in one another's line of fire. Quite professional, actually. That is a game changer. It doesn't mean that the lone wolf or the lone offender style threat is gone. It's still very much there. But what's much more dangerous is the foreign directed plot, A. B, the second thing that really caught our attention with the Revere's plot 15 months ago was the cross-jurisdictional nature of the plot. This was not something that was just in Belgium. The person who was overseeing the plot, who himself was a Belgian citizen, was in Greece at the time. Other parts of the investigation took authorities to the Netherlands, to Germany, to France, etc. And we're now seeing that as a real problem with plots in France being plotted and prepped for in Belgium and beyond. There are plots that are being thwarted in the UK. There was just another that was thwarted in Germany. So we're dealing with not hundreds and hundreds, although we honestly don't really know the number, but we assume dozens of foreign terrorist fighters who have returned from Syria and Iraq, have recruited a few more people, people who haven't yet traveled, but they are giving them some training. And if, for example, all you're going to use them for is a suicide bomber, they don't need that much training. And coming back and overseeing these foreign directed plots. That changes the whole nature of the threat. And so while the public may have legitimately felt a significant amount of shock after the Brussels bombings that something like this could even happen, authorities didn't have the luxury of being surprised, because over the past 15 months we've seen an increase in the number of foreign directed plots, even as we've seen lone offender plots continuing as well. I was in Brussels, as you heard, the week before the bombings. And the reason I was there is because of these trends that I'm talking to you about. A few months after the Verveer's plot, the Department of Homeland Security here in the United States issued an unclassified intelligence briefing for local and state law enforcement, warning about these cross-jurisdictional plots, warning about foreign directed plots, even as we need to be concerned about the lone offender, and documenting how things were different ever since Verveer's. So I went to Belgium to meet with officials and see what could be done to mitigate against the different nature of this threat. As it happened, I was sitting with a very senior Belgian counterterrorism official, the chief counterterrorism official for one of their agencies, on that Tuesday before the bombings, a week before the bombings, as they were plotting a raid in the neighborhood of Forest, which is about maybe 3 miles from where we were sitting in the city center and not far from Molenbeek, the neighborhood that has been a nexus to almost every one of the cases involving Belgium, which I'll get to in a minute. And when they carried out this raid, they thought that this was going to be a simple, straightforward raid. There was no electricity running to the safe house. They thought that it was a former safe house. They were hoping maybe to find some papers or something there. And they were quite surprised when, as they approached the door, someone shot at them from the other side of the door, injuring a police officer, actually a female French police officer. They killed that person, and they found the fingerprints of Salah Abdeslam, the last remaining fugitive on the run for 4 months at that point since the attacks in Paris in November. A few days later, the day after I left on that Friday, they actually captured Abdeslam in Molenbeek, the neighborhood in which he grew up, literally on the block of the Abdeslam family home, just around the corner from where he grew up. While I was there, actually the morning of this meeting with this senior official earlier that day, I went to Molenbeek. And I met with the mayor, the police chief for the regional area, West Brussels, the police chief for the local Molenbeek municipality, and most interestingly, a couple of police officers, plain clothes, from what they call their counter-radicalization cell, what we would basically call community policing, and also civilians working for the municipality in prevention, trying to help integrate families into society in the hopes of preventing their radicalization. Molenbeek is a community of about 100,000 people. It's highly transient, with about 10%, 8,000 to 10,000 people moving in and out every year. Unemployment is fairly high in Belgium overall, and in Molenbeek it's higher still, with as much as a third of the population out of work. And so as you walk through the neighborhoods, as I did, you see what looks like Casablanca, older men in tea houses sitting around and playing backgammon, younger men on the street corners, and women, young and old, of all ages, walking around with children, doing the shopping, etc. Molenbeek is predominantly Muslim, predominantly Moroccan of ethnic origin, and it has become a hotbed for recruitment. And what we see is that this is an area that has been largely ignored for decades now. And you have families, entire neighborhoods that are simply not integrated into society. You have children sometimes were pulled out of school at 11 or 12 years old, people who can't hold down jobs. And there's a disconnect with this youngest generation, second, third, fourth generation Belgian Muslims of North African descent. Most of them don't speak Arabic, but almost none of the imams in the local mosques, whether they're big structures or storefront mosques, almost none of them speak any of the three local languages. According to the officials I met with, out of the 114 imams in Brussels, only 8 speak any of the local languages, which means even if you discount for some number of imams maybe that are radical, there are certainly some that are not radical, and the community police officers can't interact with them in an effort to address the needs of the community, because they simply don't speak the language of these youngsters. And therefore, the youngsters are drawn to people who do speak their language and have some credibility. They speak Arabic. They don't really know much about their own religion. These are people who are doing drugs and are very much involved in crime, looking for Armani clothes and picking up girls. But they're also looking for belonging and direction, and they get that from radical Islamist recruiters who provide them both the social community needs they need, things they need, and also the kind of religious imprimatur to belong to something far more radical. So, you know, they offer a sense of family to people from broken homes, belonging to people who are disenfranchised from society, of empowerment to people who feel discriminated against, and maybe most importantly, a higher calling and purpose to people who are feeling adrift. And so they reach out to groups at a time, family members and or kind of groups of friends, and they say, you don't belong here, you can't work here, you can't get a job, you're not wanted here. And only then does the religious extremist ideological part come in. Clearly, you should not be living among these infidels. So in other words, what they're providing is a fast track from zero to hero, to quote one of the people that I met with. That means that some of the counter-radicalization efforts that we've been thinking about maybe need to be tweaked. Sometimes our counter-radicalization efforts have to focus on the radical Islamist message, and that certainly is the case with the recruiters, and most of these are recruiters on the street corners, not only online. But for the larger population that is vulnerable, what brings them close to this extremist group is not the ideology in the first instance. It's wanting to have a higher purpose. And that means the good news is that this is something that government is capable of doing if it puts in place good governance. That requires money, it requires time. Both of those are lacking and in short order. But it does mean that this is something that government has the capability to do if it puts its mind to it. Molenbeek is not the only community of its kind in this regard, but it is the most important one. And the fact is, you know, Belgium is a federal system built on a federal system built on a federal system. Linguistic, cultural, and geographic divisions in this tiny country of 11 million people. But the fact is that the one thing that I heard across the board, no matter where I went, is some version of the quote that Salafism is mainstream in Belgium. That is, you know, the radical Islamist ideology that is not necessarily at that point expressly violent, but is a slippery slope from Salafism to Salafi jihadism. And there was a little bit of a mea culpa. Apparently in the 1960s, there was a fire in Belgium, and the A senior Saudi official happened to be visiting at the time, and in an effort to show solidarity with Belgium, the Saudis offered to build a grand mosque and to finance imams. And the Belgians accepted this and donated property on their version of Central Park. And they didn't much pay attention after that. And the kind of imams that were funded to come were not the kind that were helping to integrate people into society. So we have a socio-cultural problem. We also have clearly a serious terrorist problem, and our counterterrorism response is going to have to address both of those. In the first instance, we're obviously going to have to map out the network and the associates of these various plots and find the people who are already in Europe or maybe coming back now from Syria and Iraq, intent on carrying out plots on the continent. And it should be noted that even though many of these plots have not targeted the Jewish community, some have, the Jewish Museum in Brussels in particular, attacks on Jewish teachers and schools in France, a lot of these plots, as we dig into them, some of the earlier targets that they thought about were Jewish targets. And this predates the foreign directed plots. You'll remember the shooting at the synagogue in Copenhagen in Denmark. I was there shortly after that attack and met with the Jewish community there. This was the lone offender model, someone who was radicalized from a Muslim biker gang, Muslim in the sense that that was their ethnicity. None of these guys were particularly religious, but the socioeconomic issues led this person to have the cognitive opening for the ideas of the Islamic State. And therefore, the second basket of things we're going to have to deal with, it's not just the pure counterterrorism, it's not going to be something that leverages federal agents or intelligence officers, but we're going to have to put in place and fund, especially fund, serious programs to address the lack of social cohesion, to address the fact that these are ghettoized communities that de facto are extensions of Casablanca sitting in the middle of Brussels. And in today's digital age, you can sit on your computer and you can watch the news and listen to the radio and read websites from North Africa. Even as you're sitting in Brussels, you can have no contact whatsoever. You walk around the streets of Molenbeek, there's not a single branch of a local Belgian bank, but there are branches of North African banks. They are completely ghettoized side. So we're going to need a counterterrorism response, and we're going to need a social response that loops in teachers and social workers and therapists and librarians to have a better grip on what's going on in our communities and changing the nature of that relationship. Now, the good news is, because this is not their aha moment that came 15 months ago, to their credit, the Belgians actually had put things in place, but they're very, very early on. So the counter-radicalization police cell that I met with, it's a really ingenious and creative and forward-thinking idea. But there are eight officers in a municipality of 100,000 people, and that includes getting plussed up with a few more people after the attacks in Paris last November. Similarly, the prevention officers in Molenbeek, who were perhaps the most impressive people that I have met with on the issue of counter-radicalization, and I spend an annoyingly significant portion of my time on this issue, they were really impressive. They were not soft in any way. They got it. They understood it. But there were three of them for a population of 100,000 people. There are other concepts and programs that they've begun to put in place. They've trained up over 17,000 police officers to begin to be able to identify signs of radicalization. That's great, but it's just the beginning, and there's much more that has to be done. Finally, it's not just a question of Brussels. Brussels is a particular problem for several reasons, most notably the fact that it is such a small country with such a divided government, and that makes communication and information sharing across government very difficult, and also because it has become, over the time, the launching pad for the smuggling of weapons into Europe, including countries where it's harder to procure those weapons. The weapons for the attacks in Paris, both in November and in January 2015, all came from Brussels, and that does not surprise. But it's not just a question of Brussels. Each individual European Union member state has its issues, and more to the point, the European Union overall has its issues. The Schengen free travel zone is a great boost to the economy, but it is a security vulnerability. There are ways to address that. There is something called the Schengen Information System, the SIS, but it's only as good as the data that is inputted into it and the extent to which it is accessible and then used at border crossings as people are trying to cross for the first time into the EU Schengen zone. And so far, there are plenty of crossings that don't have access to SIS. There are plenty of countries that don't put information into the system, and so it's not particularly effective yet. And to give you one other example along these lines, the European Union's counterterrorism czar, who I met with in his last report, notes that though we know that there are at least 5,000 verified cases of people who have gone to fight in Syria and Iraq from within EU member states, EU member states themselves have only reported to Europol, which is the EU's police agency, about 60% of that number, about 2,700 something. And so they're far short of even what we know for a fact to be true, let alone that which we don't know. And what's more disturbing still is that over 90% of the reports that have come in, which themselves only make up about 60% of the known truth, but over 90% of those reports only come from 5 member states. That means 23 European Union countries aren't even reporting any foreign fighters whatsoever. This is going to be a watershed moment for the EU and for EU member states because they recognize very, very strongly just how vulnerable they are. It's not clear how quickly they'll be able to put in place the kind of protections that need to happen, but it's something that will be getting a lot more attention and hopefully funding as well as we move forward. Finally, I just want to say we do need to pay close attention to protection of Jewish communities and to the impact of attacks like these on Jewish communities. The one thing that all these radical Islamists share is a particular hatred for Israel and Jews. And there are also unintended consequences. The Brussels bombings came just before the holiday of Purim, and in some communities, Belgian authorities went up to the Jewish communities and said, you know, there are certain types of costumes you shouldn't wear. Maybe you shouldn't be wearing costumes at all, because they were worried not that the Jewish community might do something, but that bad actors would be able to hide by putting on masks themselves and then carry out some type of attack within the Jewish community. The Jewish community in Antwerp in particular is very, very concerned about its security, and the Belgians are saying they're able to address that need, but the Jewish community is not 100% sure. It's not enough to put an armed guard outside of a building, and in fact, we had armed guards at all the metro stops too. That doesn't necessarily prevent an attack. And we do need to be looking carefully at certain types of targets, Chabad targets in particular, buildings that are clearly Jewish, and as we saw in France and with threats last week in Turkey, attacks in France and threats in Turkey to Jewish schools, which is obviously a very soft target and one that is particularly disconcerting when plots are targeting children. Let me stop there because there's a lot more I can say, but I'd like to be able to address whatever questions or concerns you have, including if you want what this means for us here in the United States. I am grateful for the opportunity to do this conference call, and I'm happy to take whatever questions you have.
Well, Matt, thank you very much for that interesting and, of course, sobering information. We are now getting ready for the question and answer portion of the program, so you will be hearing a recorded message on how to find a place in our question queue. If you are interested in asking a question, you press *6. That will get you queued up, but then to actually be assigned a place, you need to press 1, and your line will be unmuted when it is your turn to ask a question. And as we wait for people to join our question queue, I get the opportunity to start with a question. And I know that you started with talking about underreporting of returns of fighters returning to Europe. One of the other things that I've read is that a similar problem is that European countries don't communicate well with each other and don't share information well, and that the United States actually plays a dominant role in assisting in these communications. I'm wondering if that's true and how we're assisting, and if that will eventually help us if and when foreign-directed plots find their way to U.S. soil.
That's an excellent question. We have been providing a kind of liaison service for a lot of the Europeans. And sometimes it's because we have better bilateral relationships with each of these countries than they sometimes have with one another. And sometimes it's because of the nature of what we demand and are able to demand because we are not European. We can therefore demand certain things of European countries that they can't demand of one another. For example, passenger manifest data, PNR data. We are able to get greater access to not only data about people who are flying directly to the United States, but more generally about European travel patterns than the Europeans can themselves. I'm not one of these people who says that privacy concerns are unimportant. I do believe that, like most things, there's a balance. We need to be able to think about the impact of our counterterrorism demands and policies on privacy concerns, but we also need to be able to address the fact that people have, they may have a right to privacy, they also have a right to walk down the street without being blown up. So how do we collect this information? How long is it shared? Those are all legitimate questions, but the Europeans clearly need to be able to share this information with one another and do so in a timely manner. Another example is financing. We have something that I was involved in running back when I was at the Treasury Department called the TFTP, Terror Finance Tracking Program, which basically looks at data through the SWIFT bank-to-bank electronic fund transfer system and is able to use that to identify illicit trends and sometimes even thwart plots. There's an understanding with the SWIFT Corporation and with the European Parliament on for the context of those types of searches so that everybody is comfortable. It used to be that the U.S. government would be going to the Europeans and saying, hey, you need to expand the search parameters and what's allowed because of the nature of the threat. But we're not the only ones doing it nowadays. Again, the EU Counterterrorism Coordinator's recent report calls on member states to make changes to what they have demanded. So, for example, if you and I were in Europe right now and I were to send you a bank-to-bank transfer in euro, so it's in euro and it's within the European Union, right now there's a cutout for that. That's not covered within the data accessible by the Terror Finance Tracking Program. It's not the United States that's saying, hey, we have to change that. It's the European Counterterrorism Coordinator saying, hey, we need to change that. And so there's a lot that has to be done to facilitate the sharing of information within and between European countries as well.
Okay. Thank you very much. I want to remind people that if you have a question, you need to press 1, or excuse me, star 6, and then press 1. And I see that we have a question. Please also state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, this is Jonathan from New York. My question is, with the rise of ISIS in countries such as Libya, which is so close to Europe, will that have an effect on the presence of ISIS in the rest of Europe?
The connection wasn't great, but if I understood it, it was concerns about the Islamic State in Libya and the impact on Europe because of the proximity?
Yes.
So there are actually three different Islamic State components or provinces or waliyat in Libya, and they are something that is of increasing concern for us and for the Europeans. In fact, as we are seeing the beginnings of success in new counterterrorism posture and policies that are making it more complicated for Europeans to travel to and from Europe and Syria, Iraq, we're beginning to see people travel to Libya. Of course, for southern European states in particular, that is a particularly disconcerting issue. And it's not just Libya. Tunisia is the one kind of remaining hopeful place in the wake of the what was called the Arab Spring. But Tunisia has a lot of tension. The largest number of foreign fighters from any one country in the world, not just per capita. Per capita within Europe, it's Belgium, but overall, it's Tunisia. And Tunisia's right next to Libya, and there's a lot of connectivity there. And so that's an area of particular concern. What to do about Libya is a huge problem. Europeans want us, the United States, to participate with them in a military effort there. There have been reports in the press here in the United States that the U.S. military is considering doing something like that. I think the concern is that there needs to be something in the opposition that is organized enough to be able to come in behind that before we decide to commit troops. But there is a lot of concern about having the Islamic State on not one but two different doorsteps to Europe. One of the things that makes this so different is that this is not Chechnya. This is not Afghanistan, some backwards corner of the world that's far away. This is literally at the back step of Europe, and it is therefore quick and accessible. When you consider that a large portion of the Muslim immigrant community in Europe comes from North Africa, that also presents some certain challenges in terms of the fact that it is not at all uncommon for people to be traveling to North Africa, much the way in the UK they had to deal with the fact that there's a large South Asian population, and it wasn't at all strange for people to be moving back and forth to Pakistan. So whereas we in the United States may be able to say, hey, if people are suddenly going to Pakistan, that's a little bit more of a red light, that was not the case for the UK with the Pakistanis, and it's not necessarily the case with North Africans for the Europeans. So Libya is something we're looking at very, very hard.
Thank you for that question, and just reminding everyone that if you have a question to ask, please press *6 and then press the number 1. Right now we have someone who evidently is having difficulty getting through and has sent us an emailed question, and let me take a look at this. I think this is more a specific question on Jewish communities. I know that, Matt, you've spent time in those Jewish communities. How are people feeling? We get conflicting reports whether people are ready to make aliyah, to come to the United States, or if people are feeling safe in their communities. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, and thanks for the question, and thanks for the flexibility in being able to take it on social media. It really depends on the community, and it depends on the individuals. We've seen a significant increase in people making aliyah from France. On the one hand, France is the epicenter of the threats right now. The attacks that just happened occurred in Brussels. We still don't know if that was actually their original plan or if they planned to attack elsewhere, possibly in France, and had to push up their attack planning and attack something more local because Salah Abdeslam had been arrested on Friday. There were reports that he was talking. We now know, unfortunately, that they only questioned him for about an hour about his role in the Paris attacks in November. He had been shot in the leg, so he was recuperating, and they didn't question him again until after the Brussels bombings. From an American perspective, that's crazy, and that's under the category of things the Belgians will have to improve upon. But we don't know if they were plotting to hit Brussels in the first place. I wouldn't be surprised if it was France. So there's a particular threat to France. There have been a series of successful attacks, including attacks that specifically targeted the Jewish community in France. There has been a rise more generally in anti-Semitism in France. And finally, many French Jews own apartments in Israel already. You can go up to places like Netanya in the north, and there are entire apartment blocks that are empty most of the year until the French Jews come for various holidays. And so it's easier in some ways for French Jews to kind of say, okay, that's it. We're either going to spend more of the year in Israel or we're just going to move to Israel. We already own an apartment there. I think that the French community is different so far than what we're seeing elsewhere in Europe. And we do need to watch out for the community in Belgium in case they start feeling more threatened. So far, that has not been the case, and it is a somewhat slightly more different community, more Haredi community, and invested in the diamond industry in particular, not the whole community, of course, but an important piece of it. Elsewhere, it hasn't had as huge as an impact. So in Copenhagen, for example, obviously it hit home, there was a lot of interaction with the government following up, but the government actually has followed up quite well and has done a lot to reassure the local Jewish community. So I think in this regard, France is largely different than what we're seeing elsewhere in Europe.
Again, Matt, thank you for that. I think we're either having some technical difficulties with asking questions, or we have the quietest group of Jews ever on a phone call, but I'm getting some questions by email. This one is, I don't have the name, but from Oregon. Israel claims that neither Facebook nor Twitter are helping in combating extremism of the type that ISIS and other groups are using to recruit. Can you comment at all on if those companies are being helpful in this battle?
It's a great question. It's actually a little more complicated. One of the things I'm running here at the Washington Institute, where I head our counterterrorism program, is an off-the-record series of roundtables on all things countering violent extremism in preparation of a study we're going to be doing in the summer. And these are held under Chatham House rule, so I'm not going to say, you know, who said what or what their affiliation is, but I can tell you we've been having this roundtable series, and one of the things we've been looking at is this exact question. And we have had the opportunity to interact in these with both Facebook and Twitter. In fact, a Facebook event was on the record, and if you're interested, if you go to washingtoninstitute.org, you can see the summary, the written summary of that event, and you can actually watch the whole event on video with Monica Bickert, who is the senior person from Facebook responsible for content issues and radicalization. And there's some very, very interesting things that they are now doing, Twitter and Facebook in particular. There are other platforms that we're more concerned about, Telegram and others, but I'll just give you an example of where we are with all of this. Well, first I should say, as I intimated earlier, there is this myth out there that the vast majority of radicalization is happening online. There's a tremendous amount of radicalization that's happening online, yes. But especially in European communities, it's almost always combined with some type of person-to-person, very direct outreach, usually in person. When it's not in person, it's over social media or over some type of video conferencing, Skype or something like that. But it still is that very personable, individualized outreach, not just shooting out texts and tweets and hoping it hits somebody. In the United States, the online piece is a little larger, but still the personal outreach, whether it's in person or via the computer, is very important. Right before I hosted Monica Bickert from Facebook at this event, some Islamic State fanboys, presumably, posted a threat to Facebook and Twitter executives because of their anger over the actions that Facebook and Twitter has been taking to take radical content off their platforms. It's a little bit of a whack-a-mole cat and mouse, but they're actually doing a lot right now. And they posted a threat to senior Facebook and Twitter officials. So I told my office here that, you know, we don't usually, but for this I wanted to have some, you know, retired security officials present, and someone here said to me, "Why, do you really think that the Islamic State is going to attack the Washington Institute for Near East Policy?" And I said, "No, but I am worried that some kid in his mama's basement is going to see that the Islamic State or some Islamic State fanboy Twitter feed, or in this case Telegram platform, issued a call for the good followers to support the Islamic State by targeting these infidel leaders of these platforms, social media platforms, and decide to do it on their own and see that Monica was speaking here in Washington and do something." We did have a couple of off-duty people, and there was no problem, but we all felt much more comfortable doing it, and that's where we are today. So the thing about Twitter is that it's so massive, and it's very, very hard to be able to find everything right away. They do rely on reporting. Originally, their reporting system was not very good. And Facebook had a similar problem. There was an Israeli law firm that did an experiment. They put up a basically parallel, I think it was on Facebook pages, that was, you know, very, very, very anti-Arab and very, very, very anti-Jewish in the same types of ways. And the anti-Arab one was taken down quite quickly, and the anti-Jewish one wasn't taken down right away. And I think that case kind of spurred Facebook to re-examine what their criteria were, and I do think that was an honest mistake, though a pretty ugly one. And they're getting much, much better. But the nature of these is that there's constantly going to be new Twitter handles, and Facebook has become much less of an issue, but Twitter in particular. It's a little bit like why terrorists like to target trains and metros. The metro is only successful if people can get on it and get on it fairly quickly. You know, you can't put turnstile beyond the entry point. You can't put, you know, metal detectors. It just doesn't work. So for Twitter to work, it has to be fairly open, but then we need to improve both our automated systems for identifying unacceptable content and behavior, but also the reporting requirements. And then at the end of the day, it's incumbent on you and me and all of us when we see these things to report them, because the system will only be as effective as the reporting is.
Again, thank you for your answer. We have one more that came to me by email. This one's from Hollywood, Florida, and I suppose it is at least tangentially related. This question is on the impact of the rhetoric about Muslims and Islam in our current presidential election. Is this in truth helping to recruit or send a certain message to Muslims that live in our country and abroad? Has this effect been overstated, or is this a phenomenon that we should be thinking about carefully?
Thanks for the question. And now, with the caveat that I work at a nonpartisan think tank, I will simply say this. I know of kids in school, in public school, here in the D.C. area, in school districts that have large immigrant communities, where the joke among the kids, and many a truth is said in jest, joke about what will happen if certain candidates are elected, who will have to leave the country. This, to me, is a really serious thing. I've had the honor to serve in government, including at the senior executive service level, and I've had the honor to serve alongside Muslim Americans who are as patriotic as I am. And I've had the honor to work with many Muslims and Muslim Americans in our armed forces. And I am deeply, deeply disturbed at a personal level by some of the comments and some of the rhetoric that's being used. The way I describe what's going on, for example, in a place like Molenbeek at the end of the day, is that people who don't know much about their religion, I as an American Jew know more about their religion than they do, are being radicalized to Islamic State more than they are to any Islam or Islamic ideology. These are guys who, even after they become radical, are not praying five times a day, and they're still doing drugs. It's, you know, Al-Qaeda, in a sense, was more purist. They really wanted you to be a full-fledged convert. The Islamic State doesn't care. So long as you pledge allegiance and you do what has to get done, they really don't care. Now, if you make the hijra, if you migrate to them, then they will certainly enforce their variation of extremist Islam on you. And by the way, when that happens, many, many, many of the people who come to them leave because that's not what they expected. The myth of this idyllic Islamic caliphate is just that. It's a myth. I don't know of actual evidence that the Islamic State has had any success in using this as a recruiting tool. It is true that it has been something that's popped up on social media, and it is very logical for them to use it, to be able to say, look, you know, American presidential candidates are not against Islamic State. They're not against a particular type of observance. They're just against Muslims. And we need to push back against that. I'll be very blunt. I think we as American Jews need to push back against that. And that's not meant to be a partisan comment. People are scared, and they want to feel protected. And the fact is that the majority of the international terrorism threats we're facing today are coming from within a small, small sliver, but within one religious community. And that can make people feel very uncomfortable. What people need to realize is that, in fact, there are more violent incidents in this country having to do with white supremacist groups than there are with Muslim extremist groups. The biggest threat is still from the most extreme Muslim extremist terrorist groups, no question. But that should not be a reflection on the larger Muslim community, which at the end of the day includes our best allies in pushing back on this ideology. And I'll just say that in that regard, the people who are doing the most incredible efforts to take back the space within Muslim communities and to push out the kind of bullying voices of Islamic extremism are Muslim Americans working in their communities. One of them, a good friend of mine, is a woman who covers her hair and prays five times a day, Muslim American woman born in L.A., and the FBI has reached out to her and is using her to put together programs around the country. This is an amazing, amazing, amazing woman, and I'm proud to work with her from time to time. And so we need to be very, very careful not to tar and feather our fellow American Americans who happen to be not Christian or Jewish or whatever, but Muslim.
I want to tell you that I appreciate your comments and respect also your statement about the Washington Institute and its nonpartisan approach. Just to reiterate, the JCPA as well is a nonpartisan organization, a nonprofit, but nevertheless, appreciate your general comments. I think that we are probably running out of time. I don't know if you have any other last comments, Matt, that you'd like to make before we end the call.
I'll just say that if people have questions or comments that they either didn't think of or didn't want to share publicly, you can reach me through our website at washingtoninstitute.org. Happy to continue the conversation. Linda, I want to thank you and the organization for organizing this. We clearly have a tremendous amount of work ahead of us. I think the United States is uniquely placed to help the Europeans overcome the walls that still exist between their information sharing, both within countries and across the EU. Finding ways to make sure that Europeans feel comfortable from privacy perspectives, but feel comfortable still with sharing information that needs to be shared in an effort to make their communities safe. And at the end of the day, this is something that is affecting every one of us. You know, I'm someone who goes to Europe all the time. You see threat reporting, it's very scary. We see that things can happen here in the United States, whether it's Al-Qaeda-inspired cases like the Boston Marathon bombing. Hit home for me, not only because I testified in that case, but because I'm from Boston originally, and also San Bernardino, of course. At the end of the day, I think it's very important to end on this note just saying we should not be changing our lifestyles in ways that are unnecessary. We should not do things that are unnecessary. We should be aware of our surroundings. The see something, say something mantra from the Department of Homeland Security sounds silly, but actually it's really smart and it has been very successful. But I recommend that people go about living their daily lives, whether it's here or traveling to Israel or traveling to Europe. Be safe and don't do things that make you uncomfortable. But I wonder if we would feel as scared today if it weren't for the 24-hour news cycle, the cable news networks, and social media. There's a perception that things are happening faster and more furious than they even are because we're bombarded by it. And our adversaries are very, very dangerous, and they do mean us harm, but they are not 10 feet tall. And there are people who are working day and night to keep us safe, and we should go about living our lives.
I want to add an amen to that, and I want to thank you so much for the work that you do and for being on the call. And if I might add, a great big thank you for the Washington Institute as well and all the wonderful work that they do that helps us so much. Thank you also to everyone who joined us on the call today. The recording of this call will be available on the JCPA website. And on behalf of the JCPA, I want to wish you a very good afternoon. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to partner with you.